NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can hear us, our live stream 24/7, where no matter where you are, if you have an internet connection, you can hear us. And you can hear people like Peter Kimball, who is our guest in this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. And that's a short, computer specialist, computer trainer.
Yeah, something like that.
And
it's a mouthful.
That's right. And he is here to answer your questions now that we've got the title out of the way. We can answer your questions about computers of any kind, software, hardware, what have you. You'll be able to take a shot at it. And he's got the computer terminal here, and we'll see what we can do with your questions, which you can call us with at 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free call, 333-WILL. Or 1-800-222-WILL. We have people already waiting with a couple of questions. Let's go straight ahead then to line one in Urbana. Good afternoon. You're with Peter Kimball.
Good afternoon. I've got a question with regard to unplugging the USB port. They always say that you should click off the USB port before you unplug it. And what happens if you don't? Because I'm getting a very slow boot up, a black screen, and disconnections from the internet, and it all happens if I unplug my USB port without clicking off.
So when you what is it that you have plugged into that USB port? What kind of a device?
I ran my keyboard and my mouse through that all the time, but occasionally I put my flash memory card into it. It's a hub.
Okay, and so what you're unplugging is the flash memory card then?
No, I unplugged the hub.
Oh, okay. And does the hub have the keyboard and mouse
right
into it?
Right.
Generally, the message that you're getting about unplugging and disabling USB devices or turning them off before you remove them is more oriented for flash storage devices, digital cameras, that sort of thing. Windows in general does not take too kindly to having its mouse or keyboard unplugged, which I gather is what you're doing then when you're unplugging the USB hub.
Yeah, I unplugged it when the machine was off, and I plugged it back in. But I turned the machine back on. But I may not have gotten the keyboard USB plug into the same port on the hub. So I'm thinking maybe that threw something off.
Well, that shouldn't have made any difference. What would be depending upon the geography of your desktop and how long your cables are. Usually, you might be a little bit better served to plug the keyboard and mouse directly into USB ports on the CPU itself if you've got them and save the hub for flash drives and digital cameras and such to avoid that problem. But it would take a little bit of experimentation to see just what the problem was. Generally, if you were to unplug it when the power was off and you plugged it back in, the computer should have no way of knowing what's going on, and you should not have gotten that error. So I suspect that perhaps not getting it plugged in quite thoroughly might have been part of the problem.
So a black screen on boot up and losing the internet connection must
be
something else.
It could well be, although if it comes up and it doesn't think it has a keyboard and it doesn't think it has a mouse, I'm not quite sure what would happen at that point. But the it's as if the boot up process has been halted, so it's not quite like the blue screen which comes up when the system crashes. It's just not getting itself up far enough.
Yeah. Okay, thank you much.
But do try plugging the leaving the mouse and the keyboard into a standard USB port on the CPU itself and see if that causes a problem to not recur.
I did that, and it's still getting that black screen. And I've tried to fix the sectors on the disk and defrag the disk and all sorts of things, but it's just one of those things.
Have you had it? Has it been very slow response when it has been running sometimes?
No, not really. I mean, once it boots up eventually, it runs fine, but then it will just periodically disconnect from the internet while I'm doing online gaming, and that's a problem.
Sure, because while you're disconnected, you're done for in the game.
I die a lot.
Oh, okay, yes. I don't have a real good suggestion other than your attempt to look at the hard drive. I've had a couple of systems where the hard drive sectors are getting a little bit flaky, and so I've run a utility program that actually goes over, reads, writes, inverts, rewrites, and then restores, essentially exercising every sector, and that has caused some problems to disappear for a while on some systems.
Really? What's that program?
The one I use is something called SpinWrite. It's from, I think if you just do a search for SpinWrite, spelled R-I-T-E, okay, from Gibson Research.
Okay.
And so that has helped a lot with disks that are getting a little bit flaky.
Well, it's worth a try. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks for your call. And I've noticed again that you can never have too many USB connections on a computer.
No. And unplugging them and replugging them, the other possibilities are if one of the connectors is bad and sending spurious information or is getting worn from lots of activities. So there are some potential problems with having those nice pluggable, unpluggable things.
Is there a limit to the number of devices you can plug into a single USB port that may have like a multiple port plugged into it? Is it the same concept as, you never can plug more than three or four things into an electrical outlet? What about USB ports?
It depends. Some USB devices actually draw power from the USB port.
Right.
Others are self-powered. There would certainly be a limit on the ones that draw their own power from the USB port. A digital camera would not be in that category because when it's plugged in, generally running on its own batteries, but some things like portable diskette drives, if somebody needs that,
right,
and certainly the USB, the little smart drives, which don't take much power, but there are some things which are semi-mechanical that plug into them which do require power, and so you'd need to make sure that the USB port, if you're doing that, is itself a powered one that has its own little brick that plugs into the wall.
But generally with a solid-state sort of thing, you wouldn't have to worry
generally,
too much
about
that.
No, you wouldn't have a power issue with that, and the USB, nobody's likely to hit any limits on how many different devices there are.
All right. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line two, a caller in St. Joseph. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have two questions, one regarding broadband and the other ISPs. I heard this morning on the radio that the stimulus package is going to address broadband in rural areas. And can you just tell me briefly what that means? What is broadband? What is that?
Broadband means basically a fast internet connection. It's called broadband because it's more like a multi-lane highway for transferring signals back and forth as opposed to a single-lane country road. You often hear of people in urban areas who are using cable modems or from the phone company, DSL lines.
Mm-hmm.
Your limit of speed with a really excellent dial-up connection is usually seldom more than 45 or 46,000 kilobits per second, and you're up to millions potentially with a broadband connection. It makes a lot of the information that's out on the internet much more practical to use and download, such as audio and video files and such, which, as you know, if you're dialing up, doesn't work all that well.
Yeah, that's true. I actually live in a rural area, and I've been using dial-up with the U of I server, and you probably know that service is going to be discontinued.
Yes, they are ending that in July 1st, I believe.
And I live west of St. Joseph, kind of between Mayview and Sydney. I have a 99 Dell computer, but I have no Ethernet port. So I guess that restricts me to using phone lines. So I prefer to use something faster than dial-up, and I prefer maybe a local provider for easy access to a live person for assistance with computer-related questions. I just wonder if you had any thoughts or suggestions.
Well, if you have, and this is a desktop machine?
Yes, it is.
Well, you've got a couple of options. One of the simplest, if it doesn't have an Ethernet port, it's very affordable and not very technically difficult to get an Ethernet network interface card. It's just a card that would plug into one of the slots. You do have to open the case of the computer, but then you'll have a Ethernet connection. It's the way most computers had to have Ethernet connections added to them or network connections in the old days before they came built in on a lot of the newer machines. It's essentially just using one of the expansion slots, and you'd be able to find those for $20-$25 pretty easily. If you didn't want to go that route, and if the machine is recent enough to have USB ports, it is possible to get a USB network adapter that would go from Ethernet, but if it's a machine that is old enough that it doesn't have a built-in Ethernet port, and if it does have USB, it's probably the old original USB specification, which would be pretty slow. Better than dial-up if you went that route, but I would think for $20 or $25 and perhaps the help of a neighbor kid if you're not comfortable doing it yourself, just putting in a network, essentially Ethernet interface card would be your best approach.
Ethernet interface card, huh?
Yeah, well, it's a network interface card, but it has an Ethernet connector on it. So it gives you the missing connector that did not come built into your machine.
Oh, great, great, great. Okay. All right. Good.
And,
all right. Yeah, that'll be helpful. Thanks a lot.
Quite welcome.
And thanks for your call. Let's go on to line three. Good afternoon. Here's your chance to ask a question of Peter Kimball.
That's good. Thanks. Yeah, I've got a Mac, an iMac, 20-inch, and I'm running the current operating system. And we've got a DSL working on a wireless router. It's been working really well until a couple of upgrades ago. We did the automatic system upgrades, and we noticed a performance hit on downloading web pages primarily and even operation of a Windows remote desktop back to our office computers. We are able to bring our Windows-based laptops into the house, and they run without any performance hit. And so I've looked online. I haven't gotten a clear read on what the possibilities might be. And so I would guess my initial question is, have you heard about this kind of problem at all? Do you have any thoughts on what it might be?
So the problem is only with the with your iMac.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring in a Windows machine, and it's working just fine.
Yeah, it works really quickly.
Are there any other difficulties you found with the connection to the internet? It's just slow speed. It's not sometimes locking up or anything.
Although we will get, when we do a remote desktop connection, it will occasionally drop off. But I think that's, I'm not sure how that's configured. So I just assumed it doesn't seem to be the actual internet connection is dropping. I get the impression it's just not responding fast enough for the configuration remote desktop connection. So usually the websites will connect, but they take sometimes 2 minutes to get a web page to load. And the same web page on the Windows at the same time on their laptop will be, you know, 10 seconds, 5 seconds. It's just a normal fast DSL speed.
I don't have, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give you a very good answer on this because I've not worked with Macs as much to recognize that particular problem. I presume you've done the searches online for wireless Mac difficulties, slow page loading and such, and haven't found really any satisfaction.
Well, some of them suggest you have to go back to possibly the firmware on the router, the wireless router. But my thought was, since I'm not getting that problem with the Windows, that didn't seem to be a likely solution. My power cycle, the router, that doesn't seem to give us a help. There were some other suggestions somebody had with regards to how the Mac, airport configuration is set up for firewalls, and I haven't really gone through that yet. I wasn't sure if there were tools like within the admin tools or different things I could use to sort of troubleshoot and figure out where the bottleneck is. If it is a, you know, I don't know. I haven't really messed with it at that level, and I haven't found anything that's. There were a couple of easy checklists, and I've gone through the easy ones, like you say.
Right.
And there was even an upgrade for Java and what they call the security upgrade that both looked like they might address caching, which some of the pages were coming up slow, even though I'd just gone to them. So the caching seems to have been an improved response for recently loaded pages, but the new pages are just, you know, are still really slow, and that remote desktop connection's always been a good indicator as well.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Have you been, I guess I'm going to have one other suggestion as a resource for you. You've been looking at all the various online materials, obviously.
Yeah.
Have you tried logging into any of the Mac forums and posting your question?
I just found one that had a couple of good tutorials, and I was about to do that as well. I haven't had a chance. I heard you on the radio, so I thought I'd throw it by you.
Well, we are actually making a slight change in this program. I'm going to be alternating every other month with a couple of colleagues of mine who have a lot of Mac expertise,
okay.
Which doesn't do you a lot of good now. But what I do in that sort of a situation is I'll go to one of the forums like Mac Forum or something of that nature, log in, post the question. You'll want to have one that's fairly active and one that doesn't want to, you know, charge you a subscription fee. And you may find that you get a couple of dozen responses within the course of a day or two, some of which have a pretty good chance of saying, yes, I had that same problem and this is what I did with it.
Okay, yeah.
So rather than passively looking for people who happen to have posted a solution, actively get out there and say, here's my problem.
Yeah, some of the solutions I had were also a couple years old, and this...
Which doesn't help much, I know.
Yeah, right. I went through them just for due diligence.
Sure.
You know? But at the same time, it didn't really seem to address it. It seemed like it was an upgrade issue, but we're not even confident about that since nobody else has really posted this.
Right. And you could, I don't know if you've got, you know, the other thing you could try is you could try if you've got... you know, way back, you could back up to the pre-update, but that's kind of a drastic step to take as well.
That was kind of my thinking, too, and I mean, we could do that. I've got the original load, the disk, so I could just reinstall and then get it upgrade to a certain point.
Well, and that would be one thing, although it would be sort of a inconvenience, would be if you went back there and discovered that, yes, the problem was gone, then you know it was definitely upgrade-related. If you discovered that the problem was still there, then we're looking at some sort of issue, perhaps, with the
hardware,
with the wireless device.
Configuration or something. Okay.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Uh-huh.
And thanks for calling in this afternoon. It's the Computers News segment on the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Kimball is our guest from the U of I Fast 3 Consortium. And let's move on to your questions. Line 4 calling this afternoon from Rankin. Hello.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
How you doing?
I've got a two-parter on battery replacement on a motherboard. The first part is I've got a wrist strap for static, and it was my impression that I need to have the computer off but plugged in to ground off the static and then unplug it. Is that the proper way to do that?
That would certainly do it, assuming that the computer is plugged in properly to a grounded outlet.
Mm-hmm.
That should be fine. You could also ground yourself on any other grounded device that happens to be around there.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't have to be a ground through the computer, but you definitely want, as you are well aware, avoid static electricity, shuffling across the carpet and touching the motherboard and that kind of thing is not good. That's what the wrist strap will do for you. But any good ground, which could be the computer chassis itself, if it's plugged in, or any other device that is grounded and has a metal chassis so you can actually touch the metal.
Now, is it a myth that if the computer was unplugged but you grounded yourself to the chassis anyway, that is safe?
You'd be relatively safe. You would have discharged any difference in potential between you and the chassis, so you should therefore not get any arcing, any static electricity.
Oh, okay.
So you should be safe. But it doesn't hurt to be a little bit safer.
This machine is my favorite 1995 IBM.
Oh, yeah.
The battery finally died, and when I tried to boot it up, I got a whole host of error messages, including password expired, and did I want to just boot, you know, basic system without saving, all that kind of stuff. I didn't memorize that. I was curious, did I lose any BIOS information, or is that burnt into the ether?
Well, that's a good question, and it's possible. What you'll find out, because it was done differently at various times, it may be confused, but 90, you said 95?
Yeah.
So that's a long time ago, obviously. And it could be that some of the information that was stored in the BIOS about the configuration of your hard drive is there, but you'll not really know until you go ahead and replace the battery, which is a really simple thing to do.
Yeah.
And then boot it up, and of course, among the least of your adjustments would be to put the calendar, the date and time back in, and then see what it knows about about your hard drive. You can always check the BIOS setup when you begin by holding down whichever key it was at that time, the F4 right. or the F8 or something when you boot. But probably you're going to be okay.
Is there any way?
Are you running what version of Windows are you running on this?
98, which again is my favorite program.
Yeah, okay. So, well, I think you're just going to have to take that step by step. Get the battery in there, fire it up, and it's going to initially complain because with the battery replaced, it's not going to lose the information in the future. But, of course, the volatile information is already gone. And
is
so
there a way to restore that from an outside source, or is it all like input into the
There's not that much information. I'm unaware of anybody who has an outside source, so it's not like you're going to want to flash the EEPROM or anything.
Okay.
And you may well have to do a bit of searching on another machine to find out the details if indeed you do have to re-enter information on, you know, how many heads and how many sectors and how many cylinders and that kind of thing, which we'll hope that you don't have to. But
excellent. Wonderful. Thank you for everything.
And
sure.
Thanks, and thanks for calling this afternoon. Again, our numbers are 333-9455. And 1-800-222-9455 to speak to Peter Kimball. The bad news is we've got a lot of phone calls and we've been rather busy. So you be patient and keep placing those calls. The good news is we'll have a little bit of extra time this hour than we normally do because the markets are closed on this President's Day. So we can go right up to 201 this afternoon. Let's move on to our next caller who is in Chicago on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a question about cookies.
Okay.
I have tons and tons of them. I don't know why they bother me, but they just do. Of course, I have the option of, you know, having to respond whether I want to accept them from time to time. But I read a lot of newspapers and various sites that I want them. So the computer saves passwords, right?
That is a setting that you can say, I want to save it or not, yes.
So if I remove all these cookies just from general paranoia, am I going to lose those that facility where the computer just throws up my login name and password?
Basically, the storage of your passwords is done in a slightly different place. They're not really stored in the cookies. The cookies allow a website to recognize you as a return visitor.
Right.
As a return visitor, it may well pop up saying, oh, welcome back, John or Mary or Susan or whatever. And if you then have the computer, if you have your browser set to store passwords, then from the password storage location, it can say, oh, I recognize this site and I'm going to toss the password up there.
Right.
It certainly is not, assuming you can remember some of these passwords, because they are probably still going to be stored, but you could certainly delete all the cookies. Websites will simply not remember that you've been there. They will, the next time you log on to them or visit them, store another cookie because that's what they tend to do.
Right.
So if you had a customized screen, for example, on one of the news services, these are what I want to see, it's not going to remember that. It's not going to be able to say, welcome back, John, or whomever. But it's a fairly safe thing to do, assuming that if you are asked for a password, you'll be able to come up with it. And if you're not, almost every website is going to say, if you've forgotten your password, what's your email address, and we'll email it to you, assuming that they have your email address on file, which they almost certainly do, and you remember which email address you gave them.
Right.
So if it'll make you feel better, sure, go ahead and delete the cookies.
Okay.
And if you want to clear out a lot of space and don't mind downloading the files again while you're at it, you can say delete all temporary Internet files because that is on some people's systems 50, 70, 80, even 100 megabytes.
Yeah, I always do that.
Okay.
I do it almost every day.
The cookies, you can certainly get rid of. And some cookies you would almost be happier getting with. They're not really a security risk in themselves, but you know they're kind of spying on you, especially when some of the websites have third-party advertising partners and they store these third-party cookies that can kind of keep track, oh, you've been to this site and that site. So I tend to get rid of my cookies pretty often.
And some of them look more insidious than others.
Like yeah.
advertising.com.
Sure. And some websites, it's well worth putting up with those because it's a free service and it's only free to you because they've got the advertising partner.
Right.
But believe me, those cookies that are necessary for that will be reinstalled the next time you visit that site if you get rid of them. So you're not going to lose it. It's probably a little too tedious to try to go through and pick which ones to delete manually. So I would tend to recommend that people just get rid of all of them and just be willing to re-identify yourself to a couple of sites that you've actually using the cookies to say, here I am again.
Right, but they're not essential to my passwords.
No, they are not.
Browser. Right.
The cookies themselves are not passwords. The cookies may tell a site that this is you, and so therefore, if you've told that site that you, and not many sites do this, that you want to log on without a password, but then you just have to tell the site that it's you again.
Great help. Love the program. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. And obviously, there are some programs there and some websites that operate best when you have the cookies enabled so that you
Yes.
It does know who you are. And
well, and that's a critical issue. The caller was going to be deleting existing cookies, which is fine. You can tell a browser to not accept cookies at all, in which case a lot of browsers and a lot of websites, the browsers will still work, but a lot of websites won't.
So a lot of those extra
because
things.
As they pass you from one page to the other, they expect to know that you've already logged on, and they do that usually through the means of indirectly through means of cookies.
So they're not necessarily a security risk, but
no.
On the other hand, sometimes they can be kind of bothersome.
And they can be a little bit snoopy sometimes.
Yeah. All right, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We're taking your computer questions for Peter Kimball of the U of I. Let's go to line two and a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. So my question is about my internet connection. I use IRC, which I guess is probably not too common anymore, but there's a venture with wherein the people I collaborate with, we meet on IRC.
Okay.
I find that oddly, around 10 p.m., my connection starts being very high latency and it gets unresponsive at times and it'll drop me. And this consistently happens around 10 p.m. My theory is that I'm being throttled, like my connection's being throttled, but I can't seem to get a straight answer about this from my ISP, which is Comcast. I was wondering if you had any insights into that problem.
Well, you're probably not being throttled because Comcast ran into a whole bunch of negative publicity for actually trying to do just that with people using certain file sharing programs, therefore violating what's often termed net neutrality. Cable modems, such as through Comcast, essentially you are sharing a connection, a total capacity, with a number of people in your neighborhood on the same what they call a cable node. So there might be 150 or 75 or 250, some number of homes all connected in such a way that you don't really see the other information there, but it all has to go through the same pipe. And what you are describing is a very common experience. About 10 o'clock is when a lot of people, especially a lot of younger people, are going to get on the internet and start doing things, and your fair share of the total capacity of the cable bandwidth drops from being able to use maybe 10 or 15% of it to being able to use 1 or 2% of it. So the advertised 10 megabit per second download is only best possible scenario with nobody else logged on to the same node on the cable system.
Okay,
so you would probably find, for example, if you got up at I'm just being a little facetious here, but if you got up at 6 a.m., you'd probably find it's really fast for much the same reason. So, no, I don't think it's any active steps being taken by Comcast. It is simply a limited bandwidth now being shared by more and more people, and it's just the really popular time.
You think that would cause latency? Because the thing is, when I use other services, they seem to work okay. Like, I can still load web pages at reasonable speeds. If I go to a bandwidth testing site, my bandwidth is still acceptable. It's just that my IRC connection is high latency.
Well, there could be another issue going on, but I suspect that it's just going to be more obvious with IRC and a lot of the bandwidth testing. If you have momentary congestion, I think that would probably be more noticeable in IRC, which for other listeners is inter-relay chat. It's kind of a form. That's also, by the way, one of the major mechanisms that a lot of the spam botnets use for their work, but I don't think they necessarily restrict themselves to 10 o'clock. But that could be the other thing that's happening. It could be at the level of the IRC servers themselves.
Well, no one else was having this problem, so I think it's my connection.
Okay. So everybody else at that time is that you're conversing with says, oh, we're fine. Okay. So, yes, it is probably just the connection. There's really – I would find it very surprising given Comcast's notorious bad publicity that they are intentionally throttling IRC. They have talked about trying to allocate bandwidth more even-handedly, and depending on what all is going on in your IRC chats, if there's a lot of stuff being transferred, especially uploading is much more – because you don't have nearly the upload speed that you do on cable as you do download.
Right. Well, we're just chatting. I thank you for your help.
Yeah.
Ed, thanks for your call. And is there any way of monitoring how much bandwidth is being used on like a cable node? Can you go and see how busy your signal is at any given time?
Well,
cable modem.
Not with. You can obviously test your own bandwidth that you've got because right. There are a number of websites that will test and say, well, you were getting 5 megabits per second download and something up.
But you can't say it's because this guy down the street is on BitTorrent.
No, you can't really say that. Now it is possible there is software depending upon how Comcast has done their architecture. It is possible with appropriate software and hardware to be monitoring all of the traffic on your cable because you're on your particular cable node. Mm-hmm. So you could see with that sort of software whether you've got 20 other people using it, 100 other. It's not for all of Comcast, just your own little branch of the tree. And you could get a measure of how much traffic is going on. That's generally not done. It's not anything that you could do with standard Windows or Macintosh software, but you can download that sort of thing. And I suspect that the Comcast modems, the cable modems that people install, probably make that difficult to you'd have to override the standard setting and put it into what is actually called promiscuous mode, so it looks at everybody's signal and not just the ones coming to that particular. To your particular address.
There's something actually officially called promiscuous mode.
Yes, it's promiscuous mode for snooping, and that's why you don't really want to be doing secure business with passwords and credit card numbers, et cetera, unless you're sure you've got a encrypted, secure connection, a little padlock.
Little padlock on the bottom of the browser.
Or whatever it is, yes.
All right. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 are phone numbers for Peter Kimball. Let's move on to line 3 and a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Promiscuous mode. I like it.
Yes.
Boy, oh boy. Three questions. First off, are any of the buildings in the U of I, do they have public access Wi-Fi ports, just any Joe Schmo can walk in with his laptop and get a signal?
Several of them do. I'm not sure what the current list is. The Krannert Center, Willard Airport,
mm-hmm.
And I think there are a few more. If you go to...
Probably the Illini Union.
Yes, probably the Illini Union, possibly the Assembly Hall,
mm-hmm.
And you can go to... the CITES, CITES website, and do a search there. That'd just be CITES.illinois.edu, and do a search there for Wi-Fi or public Wi-Fi access. They have a list of buildings, and I think there are probably at least half a dozen and more all the time. Some buildings have Wi-Fi, but only if you've got a U of I net ID. But
right.
Some of them are definitely
–
yes, but some of them are definitely now becoming more
okay. Yeah,
publicly available, and that list is available from CITES.
Secondly, is there any other game in town for high-speed broadband other than Comcast that you know of?
Well, those are the two big ones. DSL, the digital subscriber line from AT&T, which you can get at various speeds depending on how much you want to give them every month,
mm-hmm.
And Comcast, which is just one speed for all, although they have a business speed that's a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to go that route, then you are going to be looking at much more expensive options that are not going to be as fast. So unfortunately, the only kind of wires that are coming into your house are typically the phone wire and the cable wire.
Yeah.
And the, so then you'd be looking at wireless options or satellite options, which are either very expensive or not quite as fast. Assuming that some of the wireless providers, which are primarily oriented towards those in rural areas that don't have the other options, you could go
years
that route.
Years ago, when the city of Urbana was gnashing its teeth about buying the water company or something like that, I was thinking, what's the matter with you guys? Why don't we wire this town for 100 meg, internet access and screw Comcast? But anyway, and my last question is, I'm about to replace a very antiquated Dell computer that we've been using to control the Wi-Fi network in the house.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming I should just go step by step, hook the new computer up, hook it up to the cable modem, get that working properly, and then hook up the Wi-Fi and get that working properly. Any tips or ideas you have along that line?
Well, so what you're currently doing with the Dell is just having it act as a network hub, then,
whatever it does, it's what I loaded the software on to control the wireless router.
Okay, so it is just a and so you want to replace that, but you have other machines that you are using throughout the house,
yeah.
And the Dell machine that you're replacing is the only one that's physically wired into the wireless router.
It's the one that controls. I've got another a second machine right next to it that's connected via a LAN cable to the wireless router itself, but it doesn't have the control software for the, password or the encryption codes and all that jazz in it.
Well, what kind of wireless router do you have? Do you know offhand?
A TrendNet, I think.
I don't recognize that particular brand. But
it's the older G. It's not the newer standard.
802.11b/g, etc.
Well,
most routers, those from Cisco, Linksys, and various others, don't really require these days specialized software be installed. If you look at the user guide, you type in a web address, a local web address, so it'll be in the form of like HTTP, all the rest, .169.68, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an administrative password that defaults to just be, I think, blank, but hopefully
so
you change it.
So
you may not, yes, you should be able to access.
Oh, cool.
Basically, the reason for that is that almost every, at least relatively modern wireless router, has a very small web server built into it so that you can communicate by a machine that is wired physically to it by just typing in the address, and then you can control the wireless passwords and everything else. So you may not need to replace that machine.
Yeah, well, it'll be fun. I'll find out what happens here.
Yeah, and if you can't find the information on that because you've misplaced your user guide, you can. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Should be good.
And thanks for your call. Now, there are a couple of options. Is Volo still around as far as a broadband service in Champaign-Urbana?
I know the Prairie iNet is, but and I believe it is.
These again are systems that may that use different ways of transmitting a signal, not cable, not DSL,
right.
Which may be around or not.
And boy, I'm not sure. Not sure.
We're looking it up online
to
see if they're still around. I thought I had seen somewhere that they were still in business, but could be wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are also options with satellite reception.
Yes, which if you're stuck and can't do anything else, that can be done. It's relatively expensive. I know one colleague who is out in an area of suburban Mahomet, if that's not a redundancy, my pardon to those in Mahomet, and they were beyond the reach of DSL or cable at the time, and so for not a large extra amount of money to their cell phone provider, they just went with the cell phone provider through Verizon, and just plugged in the card, and they were within reach of the cell tower and have pretty decent speed, certainly better than dial-up was.
A few options out there. All right, let's go to line one right now and a caller in Champaign. You're on with Peter Kimball.
Hi, Peter. I had a VHS, very short video, and wanted to end up with that 3-minute video going onto a little website. I converted from the VHS to a DVD by way of the VHS player and a normal TV burner, and succeeded then in copying that file onto my hard drive, but it's enormous, like 500 plus meg. Can you outline some efficient means via hopefully free software, et cetera, to get this file shrunk down in a suitable size and format for putting on my little website and or also YouTube?
Okay, so what you actually have on the DVD is essentially the uncompressed video that you just copied from. And so, yes, it would be huge. I need to see. There are a number. Now, the DVD burning software in your computer that ships with a number of machines may be able to read that DVD format and convert it into the compressed MPEG version that would be more like maybe a meg or two. I'd have to look that up. The program that I use, or a number of people use, it is not quite free, but it is actually fairly inexpensive, is Adobe Premiere Elements. It's like their large version of their professional video editing suite, but designed for the consumer. And it's, last I checked, it's in the vicinity of $50 or so. But it allows you to do all sorts of additional editing as well. If you do a search for a number of video editing, video converting software, I suspect we'll find a number of things there. So let's see. Let me just try a quick search here for you. Converting.
Going to specific programs and brands, can you summarize what these generic steps are?
The generic steps are, you specify, since you've got it in a digital format, you specify to this software what that what the original source file is, the huge 500 megabyte thing. With its software, what it'll do is it'll encode it and compress it into one of several different formats. And that will often, depending on how fast your machine is, you can start that up and it may run for half an hour, for an hour, in some cases even longer. But there's no real speeding it up because it's doing a whole lot of work. And then that you will end up with a file that most video software, the little things that are built into Windows and into the Macintosh, can play, such as the things you see on YouTube.
Well, I'm just parroting now what some knowledgeable friends of mine have sketched to me. I was led to believe I'll want to get to AVI and eventually FLA extension files.
That's possible. The AVI is the Windows video format, and it's certainly much more compressed. It's not entirely clear that you'd want to go to FLA. FLA is the flash file format, and certainly if you're going to be dealing with this as a flash movie, that's an appropriate way to go, but not really necessary.
Although it has to do with an existing setup we have on my website.
Okay. So
it's a flash.
Okay.
The
flash video encoder that I use, and I'm not going to be a very good resource for free software, is the one that actually comes with the flash program itself. It's Flash's video encoder, but that comes with a full-fledged flash program from Adobe. So I'm sure there are a number of other options out there. So I, again, would just suggest a search. Let me just do another quick look here for converting.
And let me, I wanted to throw out an overarching concern that is specific to my particular little video. This is a video I made years ago to go to a trade show where I knew that the principals of these companies would be very short on time and anxious to get rid of me.
Uh-huh.
So the way I edited turned out to be very successful. I made the actual tape, and this is what I've converted, run at 8x speed, and it's very much like a cartoon. It's like a Charlie Chaplin.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of getting over the concept, which is all I was and am concerned about, it was very successful and very efficient. Do you think, though, that since the original material, it was running at 8x, will this cause any unusual jerkiness or problem when I further compress it by the kind of route that we're talking about?
So your original source that you're going to be converting is the source that you had done at 8 times normal speed?
Correct.
And now when you do the conversion, you have a choice with most of the software that that converts into the various digital video formats, as you do with sound, for that matter, and audio files, how much compression you want to do, how small you want it to make. I suspect, I have not tried this, but I suspect that if you were to specify that you wanted the absolute smallest file size, in other words, to compress the heck out of the thing, it would end up being a little bit jerkier still, but at somewhat more conservative settings, I don't imagine it's going to look that much different. Those programs do a pretty good job of bringing it in. The compression is going to be a little more difficult because what that software does is it looks for changes, and the changes are coming much more quickly at 8 times the original speed. So,
it sort of automatically adjusts for that.
It should, although it is going to be, since you now have video that presumably, unless it's just somebody sitting there talking and holding things up, if the video changes rapidly, it's going to be more of a challenge to convert it, in much the way that if you've got, if you've seen satellite digital transmissions like Dish Network and others, they have, or sometimes on computers, they have more difficulty with scenes that have a lot of action, like a lot of sports scenes, and occasionally they will break up more, while those that are less movement involved will look better. And it would seem that your original 8X video is likely to have more movement than it would have, of course, at normal play rates. Unless it's just somebody standing there holding something up and doing something. So there still might not be a lot of motion. But overall, it's going to be a bit more of a challenge for it.
I see. Right? And I guess one other question, and then I think I can Google stuff. And now that I have the general route that I'm looking for, I think I can probably find that. Can you give me an idea what is a comfortable size range for the ultimate converted file?
And this would be for somebody to download and view from your website?
Yeah, I'm going to put it on the website, and the way my website is set up, there are little thumbnails. When you hit one of them for my still-type presentations, it goes into a controllable slideshow, but it can also go straight into this video. So it will be that FLA format, I believe, for that reason, because it's fitting somehow into the framework.
Sure, you're using a Flash Player window of some sort to display it. Well, realize, of course, that as soon as you go into a video, you're assuming that most people are going to have a fast connection. It's not going to work terribly well for people who are dialing up with their connection.
I'm not worried about that.
Okay.
Part, no.
In that event, usually 2 or 3 megabytes would not be unreasonable. I don't know if you're going to be streaming it, so they'll be seeing it as it downloads, but at a fast connection, even if they have to wait a few seconds or 5 or 10 or 15, you should be pretty good. So that's what my basic. I certainly would not want to get it up to 15 or 20 megabytes. That's a fairly substantial chunk of time.
Okay, 2 or 3 though would be a reasonable first target, and then
it depends upon it depends on how much motion there is and how efficiently you can compress it. The good thing is once you've got this, and I was finding there are all sorts of utilities if you just look do a Google search for converting AVI to FLA and such, including a number of free downloads. But the good news is, although it may be a little time-consuming to do the conversion, you can try it at 2 or 3 different settings and see which ones you're happiest with in terms of time to download and the quality of the finished product.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Okay,
right.
Thanks for your call. We've got a few more minutes that we can spend with Peter Kimball, as we don't have any markets to deal with today, so settlement prices are not going to be happening today, and we'll have an encore version of Commodity Week coming up at 2:06. Let's go to line 2 and a caller that's been very patient in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Afternoon. So I had a question. I looked in I downloaded one of those free. They said it's a free cleaner for your computer, and it does a scan, and it said it found all these different errors and problems. And they said it can make my computer run faster, but then you got to buy the software to get it to actually run faster. Is there any software out there that is free that can go through the computer and clean it up for you?
There are some. There are several things that you need to look at cleaning up. And there also needs to be one note of caution added here. One of the favorite vectors for those with malicious software is if you visit a website and you get a pop-up saying, we've detected that your computer is really slow, and click here and we will, automatically send you a program to fix it up. Sometimes those actually do just the opposite. So you do have to be careful and do a search for whatever company or whatever product it is that you're considering downloading and see what kind of results you get, whether it's legitimate or not. The kinds of things that can be cleaned up, certainly if there are various what's called spyware or spamware that's there. Programs like SpyBot can get rid of a lot of that, and that has a free version. There are a number of registry cleaners that are out there, but it's not entirely clear how effective that is. Mostly registry cleaners, and the registry is the giant database that Windows uses to keep track of all of its various component parts and software and all sorts of other things. Usually that doesn't present as much of a problem to people's performance as a lot of the registry cleaner software claims. It's often other programs that are running, such as spyware and such, and there are a number of programs that are good to get rid of a lot of that. You may want to try one and two or three of them make sure you've got it.
SpyBot's one of them, and I think that's what it is, because I'll try and put my computer in sleep mode, and it won't go to sleep because it sounds like something's running. Like, it'll automatically start back up, acting like something's running on my computer to prevent it from going to sleep.
Uh-huh.
So you think it's probably what it is?
Well, it could be. I mean, there are some legitimate reasons that sometimes things are happening, including legitimate antivirus software. But two that I would try are the SpyBot Search and Destroy, which is generally – and they've got a free version and a version that you can pay more for. And that's a website called www.safer-networking.org. And then another one that's been widely used for some time is called AdAware, and that's at lavasoftusa.com.
Okay.
And they, again, have free versions and slightly more expensive versions, but that would be a good start. Go ahead.
Yeah. One other quick question. My Windows was goofing up, and I closed it, and it said that there was a virus, and closed in all the windows if I had two different ones up. So I rebooted my computer to an earlier date, and when doing that, I had download a new printer, all-in-one HP printer on it.
Yes.
And now it's giving me problems again. It wants me to unblock, so something's blocking and allowing, but I took my AVG and I exited it out. I did everything I did the first time to get it to work, but now it's not working. Do you know what the problems could be?
So what you did is you did a system restore and moved back to an earlier version of the software. You
Correct.
Lost the printer driver that you had installed for your HP all-in-one.
Yeah.
And now when you try to reinstall that driver from, I presume, the CD-ROM that it came on,
yeah.
You're not able to do it successfully.
Yeah.
And it's giving you a message saying you need to unblock connection to a particular website. That's a part
of it. Yeah. Well, it says you need to unblock it. It says unblock or allow. And last time to do that, I just exited out of my AVG. I have that free, and then I have Firewall on Windows. And I just went to and accepted or made exceptions on my firewall for HP.
And then starting up again, it does not, it's still not working for you.
Yeah.
When you start up again, it's no longer asking you to unblock because you've already made the exceptions?
No, it's still asking me to, I don't know what else to unblock.
Well, it may well be asking, again, I don't use AVG, but it may well be asking, it needs to communicate with the printer, and it's asking you to unblock to what? What is the website or the...
It's not clear. It's just saying that something is blocking, this hardware from loading on.
And you don't have an option to unblock, or you do at that point?
No, I don't.
Okay.
That's another problem. Yeah, I don't have an option to. It just says I need to from somewhere, but I don't know where. So I've tried AVG and my firewall.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time a little bit here. So what I would suggest is, since it's a new HP, a